It's 5:06. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Gene Purcell, in for Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Diane Ravitch is one of the top voices on education in America, a former U.S. Assistant Secretary of Education. She's now a research professor of education at New York University.
Ravitch used to be a champion of school reform, pushing for charter schools and for No Child Left Behind. But she has since had a change of heart and now campaigns against the same things, saying they just don't work. And we'd like to know what you think about privatizing schools. Will it help? Is the public school, in your estimation, the public school system in America truly broken? Give us a call at 800-642-1234. Or you can post a comment on the Central Time Facebook page.
Diane Ravitch has a new book out. It's called Reign of Error, The Hoax of the Privatization Movement and the Danger to America's Public Schools. Diane, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you so much. Great to be with you.
Well, let's key in on privatization. You hear a lot of talk about charter schools, voucher schools, school choice. People don't throw around the word privatization that often. You chose that word carefully. Why?
Well, because that's what's happening. It's happening all over the country. Part of what has happened over these past 20 years is we have been bombarded with a narrative that says our public schools are broken, our public schools are failing. And I sat down and did the research, which anybody could have done. I should have done it a long time ago. And what I discovered is our public schools are doing an absolutely fabulous job. In fact, the test scores today on the national test, the federal test, are the highest they've ever been in history for white kids, black kids, Hispanic kids, and Asian kids. The graduation rates are the highest they've ever been in history for all four of those groups. The dropout rates are the highest they've ever been in history, and yet we have people going around moaning and saying our public schools are broken. The reason they're saying that is because they then want people to say, woe is us, let us hand our public schools over to private corporations to run. Let us hand them over to a charter chain. Let's hand them over to whoever comes along and says that they can fix them. But none of that works, and it just destroys public education.
Let's unpack some of that. Who is driving this argument that our public schools are failing?
Well, in the book, I quote chapter and verse with Bill Gates saying that our public schools are obsolete, with Michelle Rhee running around the country saying that our schools are failing, with Joel Klein and Condoleezza Rice having issued a report just a year ago. It was actually one of the motives for my writing this book, because they issued a report saying that the public school system in America was so terrible that it was a national security risk. And I began researching that while writing a review of their report and found out all of that wasn't true. So we also have heard this, the same thing from Secretary Duncan, but I don't think he's actually read the data that's on the U.S. Department of Education's website.
Well, overall, maybe we're doing okay, but a lot of the argument is focused on schools in urban areas, saying we've got an achievement gap, that the schools are failing people there, not giving them a hope for their future. Is there a real problem in big city schools?
There is a huge problem caused by poverty. It's not caused by bad schools. Many of the schools that are being closed and called failing schools are schools that are overloaded with the problems of desperately poor children, many of whom have disabilities, very extreme disabilities, and they're not wanted in charter schools, many of whom don't speak English, and they're not wanted in the charter schools either because they'll drag the scores down. So in cities across the country, what's called failing schools are schools that just have the problems of poverty that are not being addressed, and there are things we can do to make those schools better. My view is that every time a school is closed, doesn't show that it was a failing school. It shows the failure of leadership, and the superintendent should be fired when he closes the school.
Well, let's turn toward the voucher, charter, school choice movement. The argument is we'll have competition. We'll have more innovation that currently isn't there under the bureaucracy with the unions, the other things of the public schools. Isn't there some truth to that? Can't we see some improvements and some innovations in these schools?
No, actually, you can't see any truth to it. If you wanted to find the kind of poster district for why none of this is true, you would look at Milwaukee in your own state. And in Milwaukee, there has been now 23 years of vouchers and charters and a shrinking public sector. And Milwaukee is one of the lowest performing cities on the National Assessment of Educational Progress. All three sectors, by the way, vouchers, charters, and the public sector, the kids perform about the same in terms of the state test scores. So the competition has improved nothing, and the city as a whole has not improved, and that's all been money used to divide up public education into three competing sectors with no gains for the kids.
Let's look at some of the history of the school choice or the privatization movement. You, in your book, say for a while that was just on the fringe of, say, the Republican Party. How did it become such a big argument in American education?
Well, this is one of the most fascinating things that I see. I'm a historian. I've been studying American education and written books about it over the past 40-plus years. And school choice used to be the cry of the fringes of the far right. It was the battle cry of Governor George Wallace in Alabama. He wanted school choice so that white kids could go to some kids and black kids could go to some schools and black kids would go to other schools. And it was always considered a right-wing appeal. It was never considered liberal. Now you hear people on both sides of the aisle saying school choice is the civil rights issue of our time. That's ridiculous. That is, shows how the persistence of the right-wing think tanks, and I was part of two or three different right-wing think tanks, their persistence, their ability to fund the message, keep saying it again and again, and then this ongoing claim that our schools are worse than ever has made the public think, well, gosh, if our schools are worse than ever, we have to try anything. Why not try vouchers? Well, the fact is, the American public really likes their public schools. If you look at the last Gallup poll, which was done just a few weeks ago, people say, oh, American education is in terrible trouble, because they've heard that now on radio and TV for decades. But if you ask them, well, what about your neighborhood school? They'll say, oh, my neighborhood school is great. We have terrific teachers. So they really don't want their schools to be closed down. But this school choice claim that's being made is being made because of the misinformation about the performance of the system as a whole.
And you also try to follow the money in the book. Who stands to profit if schools are privatized?
Well, there are large corporate entities that now are looking on public education as an emerging market. And I report on several meetings that have been held among investors to talk about how to make money in the new public education market. Some of these companies are managing charter schools, and they look at them as real estate investments, and having the public pay for the real estate, paying themselves outrageous amounts of rent. There are also people who've run in the charter business who really have no business running schools at all. The tennis star Andre Agassi raised $750 million to open a chain of charter schools across the country. One of them, I think, will be in Milwaukee, another in Detroit, and there'll be many more. He should be opening tennis camps. I mean, he has no educational qualifications. And similarly, in Texas and other places, there are charter schools being opened by basketball stars and football stars. These are not educators. I mean, if you step back, as I tend to do, and you look at what's happening across the country where teachers are being demoralized, blamed for conditions that are beyond their control, and where people who have no educational qualifications are taking over schools, you have to say that the American education system is under siege. There are a tsunami of bad ideas that are hitting simultaneously and really doing terrible damage to public education and to our future as a nation.
Well, let's talk about federal education policy now. You were in the Bush White House when No Child Left Behind was put into effect. I'm sorry, I misspoke.
The first Bush administration.
First Bush administration, I'm sorry. Mm-hmm. But let's talk about No Child Left Behind. What do you make of the emphasis on standardized testing and teacher accountability in No Child Left Behind?
Well, the Bush administration of George W. introduced the idea that the federal government should require every state to test every child every year from grades 3 through 8, and by the year 2014, all children in America would be proficient in math and reading. It was a total hoax. No one believed it at the time. Certainly no one believes it anymore. But even at the time, no one believed it. So it was a ridiculous law because no one believed that it was possible that someday 100% of kids 12 years later would be proficient. And yet people have been fired based on that claim. The Obama administration's policy of race to the top is built right on top of the Bush No Child Left Behind. It shares the same assumptions that standardized testing is the best way to measure school performance and that we must constantly test children. They keep expanding who should get tested. There are now kids in kindergarten being tested. You have to understand, for context, there is no other nation in the world that tests every child every year. I mean, testing has gotten completely out of control in this country. And in most places, teachers test the children in their classes. They're not administering standardized testing. And so I think that the theory of if we just test, everyone gets smarter, was a bad idea. And what it's done is to cause many schools to be declared failing schools because they don't have high test scores, and demoralize teachers, and really made many kids hate school.
We're talking to Diane Ravitch. She's an education professor at New York University, long career in the education field, talking about her new book, Reign of Error.
And we'd like to hear your thinking on this, too. What do you think about the move to privatize schools and get rid of ineffective teachers? Do you believe that our public school system is in crisis? Join the discussion by giving us a call at 800-642-1234. Or you can post a comment on the Central Time Facebook page.
We'll hear more about testing, teacher evaluation, and her solutions, Diane Ravitch's solutions, to the problems that are in the education field. This is Central Time on Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Rob Verrett.
And I'm Gene Purcell. We're talking to Diane Ravitch now, former Assistant Secretary of Education and a professor at New York University. She's got a new book out challenging the move to privatize schools, and she also challenges the notion that our public education system is broken.
Her book is Reign of Error. You can join in with your thoughts on education in the United States. Is it broken? What needs to change? Do you like things the way they are? 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We'll go to the phones now. We have Jay with us in Spooner. Jay, hi.
Hi, guys. Thanks for taking my call. I just want to say I agree wholeheartedly with the with your guest in terms of our public schools are not broken, and our public schools are doing a terrific job. And I have seen articles dating back into the 1960s written by professionals in education that talk about the same exact thing that we're seeing today. And we always go back to the same thing, and that is that good teaching can't be mandated any more than good parenting can be. And that really is the root of the problem, in my opinion, is poor parenting. But I think our schools do a terrific job. And this idea that we need to keep increasing test scores and cutting funding to schools at the same time so that we can crank out little test takers, and as a result, we're losing kids who have free-thinking ability.
Gotcha. Jay, I want to jump in and get Diane to respond there. So test-taking as a way of evaluating, first of all, teachers. Why are standardized tests not a good way to figure out which teachers are effective?
Well, actually, it's the worst way to figure out whether teachers are effective. There's just a huge body of research and based on experience, not on theory, that what test scores show is who is in your classroom, not whether you're a good teacher or not. And what's happening is that the more these systems are adopted, which Arne Duncan has been insisting upon, and so now most states have said we will evaluate teachers by the test scores of their students, teachers are actually being punished if they are teaching English language learners because they don't see big score gains. They're being punished if they teach children with severe disabilities because they don't see big test score gains. They're being punished if they teach gifted children because they're already at the ceiling. So it's really a ridiculous way of evaluating teachers. And what happens is that, and this has happened in many districts that have tried this, 1 year a teacher is rated highly effective, next year the teacher is ineffective. So the teacher may get a bonus 1 year and then a notice she's about to be fired the next year. And if you ask the teacher, what did you do differently, he or she will say, I have no idea. I was teaching exactly the same way. So these systems don't work, have never worked, and will never work because test scores, first of all, I mean, the tests themselves just aren't that good, but you're measuring who is in the classroom. And let me just add, if I might, I hate the status quo. I am not defending the status quo. I think the status quo is what the federal government is doing and has been doing now for the past dozen years, what the states are doing because the federal government is forcing them to do it, and what governors are doing, like Scott Walker and Tom Corbett, cutting the budget finding every possible way to make teachers feel unappreciated and disrespected, and that's no way to improve education.
All right, thanks for the call, Jay. We'll go now to John in Superior. Hi, John.
Good afternoon to both of you. I just wanted to ask your guest about the role that unions have played in this problem. It seems like you cannot get rid of bad teachers. Our school district, the only way you can get rid of somebody is if they have pornography on their computer or they have inappropriate relations with a student. And I think the unions have been very guilty of protecting very bad teachers, and the good ones and the bad ones, they all get the same pay. What is your guest's thoughts on the union's role in this?
Well, it's a good question. The reality is that if you wanted to look at where the performance is highest in America, it's in three states, Massachusetts, Connecticut, and New Jersey. The one thing that these three states have in common is that they're all highly unionized states. Now, I don't think their performance is high because they have unions, but because unions fight for resources, and when schools don't get resources, they don't improve. You have to have, when you have kids with problems, you have to have smaller classes. There are all kinds of things that schools need, and they will not get if there's no one to advocate for them. I think that the unions have to be very responsible in making sure that there's a speedy resolution if a teacher is charged with any kind of malpractice or misbehavior or incompetence, that if they're tenured, they have a right to a hearing, and the hearing should be speedy, and there should be evidence presented, and if they're guilty, they should be removed.
Thanks for the call, John. We have Mike with us now in River Falls. Hi, Mike.
Hi. I'd like to say hi to everybody. Diane, I love your book, Reign of Error. Just finished it. I'm an administrator in River Falls. I know we're going to disagree on this. I really like the Common Core for reading language arts as opposed to our 1998 standards in Wisconsin. However, I do agree with you with all the testing that we have to do. I like to call it the oxymoronic smarter balance assessment, because I know what it does to our kids. Third graders taking tests for gosh knows how long. I just want to get your insight on how you're supporting others to kind of buck the trend of what should states and districts do to kind of get out of this testing fiasco?
Well, I believe, and I'm actually very optimistic, I believe there's a national movement building from the grassroots up. People are beginning to understand in state after state that their schools are being destroyed, that teachers are being destroyed. You cannot have a better education system if you demoralize teachers. Our schools cannot be staffed by kids who've had a few weeks of training and they're right out of college, and then they come and go. That's Teach for America. And yet places like Minneapolis is being taken over by Teach for America, and many experienced teachers are being laid off. So I think that there is a grassroots movement. We can see even, for example, in the state of Texas, the moms, the suburban moms, got so angry there that they buttonholed all the legislators, and Texas just reduced its testing requirements. In Florida, Michelle Rhee and also Jeb Bush were trying to push something called a parent trigger, where parents could sign a petition and then hand their school over to a corporation. And the moms and the dads in Florida got so angry they couldn't even find a single parent to testify in favor of what they call the parent trigger or parent empowerment. And that bill was defeated not just once but twice. So in state after state, there are grassroots groups. I could put in a plug for the Network for Public Education, the organization that I started, which is to try to connect all the grassroots groups across the country, and they're springing up in Ohio and Pennsylvania and California. They're everywhere. And these are people who are saying, that's enough. The testing has gotten out of control. Handing over our public schools to corporations is inappropriate. We don't want our tax dollars to go to profit-making organizations. So there's a lot of pushback, and it's coming from high school students, from teachers, from parents, and communities.
Diane, in our last minute and a half or so, a lot of your book is geared towards solutions to problems that do exist in the school system. I want to talk about one, or the first couple, actually, that start before kids even go to school. What can we do for young children that helps school performance?
Well, the important thing to bear in mind is that the achievement gap exists before the first day of school. So anything that we can do to make sure that young children have the opportunity to encounter social interchange with other kids, learn how to play well, exposed to new vocabulary. In other words, universal pre-K, we're way behind the rest of the advanced world. I quote a study from The Economist magazine comparing us to Europe and the advanced nations of North America. We are like number 32 or 34 in terms of providing universal pre-K. It's just taken for granted in other countries. We don't do it here. Medical care for poor kids is particularly important because they fall farther and farther behind because they miss school because of preventable illnesses. There are so many things that we could do to make school more lively, more engaging. Every school should have a wonderful arts program. There's no reason in the world that so many schools don't have the arts anymore, or that they're cutting it back on physical education. Kids have to have a reason to come to school other than to be tested.
Diane, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you. It's my pleasure.
That was Diane Ravitch, former Assistant Secretary of Education, professor at New York University. We've been talking about her new book, Reign of Error.